Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
If you want jazz music, go to New Orleans. Bagels, New York. And for psychics, think California Psychics. You want the best, you go to the best. At California Psychics, home of free spirits and open minds, we know better than anyone what makes a good psychic. That's why we guarantee, if your reading isn't life-changing, it's free. Visit CaliforniaPsychics.com and experience the joy of certainty. California Psychics.
Shoes and Stockings, a collection of short stories by Louisa May Alcott. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Carolyn Francis. Aunt Kipp, Part 1, by Louisa May Alcott. Children and fools speak the truth. "What's that sigh for, Polly dear?" "I'm tired, Mother. Tired of working and waiting. If I'm ever going to have any fun, I want it now, while I can enjoy it." "You shouldn't wait another hour if I could have my way, but you know how helpless I am." And poor Mrs. Snow sighed dolefully as she glanced about the dingy room and Pretty Mary turning her faded gown for the second time. "If Aunt Kipp would give us the money she's always talking about, instead of waiting till she dies, we should be so comfortable. She is a dreadful bore, for she lives in such terror of dropping dead with her heart complaint that she doesn't take any pleasure in life herself, or let anyone else. So the sooner she goes, the better for all of us," said Polly, in a desperate tone, for things looked very black to her just then. "My dear, don't say that," began her mother, mildly shocked. But a bluff little voice broke in with the forcible remark, "She's everlastingly telling me never to put off till tomorrow what can be done today. Next time she comes, I'll remind her of that and ask her, if she is going to die, why she doesn't do it." "Toady, you're a wicked, disrespectful boy. Never let me hear you say such a thing again about your dear Aunt Kipp." "She isn't dear. You know we all hate her. And you are more afraid of her than you are of spiders. So now." The young personage, whose proper name had been corrupted into Toady, was a small boy of 10 or 11, apple-cheeked, round-eyed, and curly-headed, arrayed in well-worn gray knickerbockers, profusely adorned with paint, glue, and shreds of cotton. Perched on a high stool at an isolated table in a state of chaos, he was absorbed in making a boat, entirely oblivious of the racking toothache which had been his excuse for staying home from school. As cool, saucy, hard-headed, and soft-hearted a little specimen of young America was Toady as you would care to see, a tyrant at home, a rebel at school, a sworn foe to law, order, and Aunt Kipp. This young person was regarded as a reprobate by all but his mother, sister, and sister's sweetheart, Van Bahr Lamb. Having been, through much anguish of flesh and spirit, taught that lying was a deadly sin, Toady rushed to the other extreme and bolted out the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, at all times and places, with a startling abruptness that brought wrath and dismay upon his friends and relatives. "It's wicked to fib. You've whipped that into me, and you can't rub it out," he was wont to say, with vivid recollection of the past tingling in the chubby portions of his frame. "Mind your chips, Toady, and take care what you say to Aunt Kipp, or you'll be as poor as a little rat all the days of your life," said Polly warningly. "I don't want her old money, and I'll tell her so if she bothers me about it. I shall go into business with Van and take care of the whole lot, so don't you preach, Polly," returned Toady with as much dignity as was compatible with a great dab of glue on the end of his snub nose. "Mother, did Aunt say anything about coming this week?" asked Polly after a pause of intense thought, over a breath with three darns, two spots, and a burn. "Yes, she wrote that she was too feeble to come at present, as she had such dreadful palpitations she didn't dare stir from her room. So we are quite safe for the next week at least, and, bless my soul, there she is now!" Mrs. Snow clasped her hands with a gesture of dismay, and sat as if transfixed by the spectacle of a ponderous lady in an awe-inspiring bonnet who came walking slowly down the street. Polly gave a groan and pulled a bright ribbon from her hair. Toady muttered, "Oh, bother!" and vainly attempted to polish up his countenance with a fragmentary pocket handkerchief. "Nothing but salt fish for dinner," wailed Mrs. Snow, as the shadow of the coming event fell upon her. "Van will make a fool of himself and ruin everything," sighed Polly, glancing at the ring on her finger. "I know she'll kiss me. She never will let a fellow alone," growled Toady, scowling darkly. The garden gate clashed, dust flew from the doormat, a heavy step echoed in the hall, an imperious voice called, "Sophie!" and Aunt Kipp entered with a flourish of trumpets, for Toady blew a blast through his fingers, which made the bows totter on her bonnet. "My dear aunt, I'm very glad to see you," murmured Mrs. Snow, advancing with a smile of welcome, for though as weak as water gruel, she was as kind-hearted a little woman as ever lived. "What a fib that was," said Toady, sotto voce. "We were just saying we were afraid you wouldn't," began Mary, when a warning, "Mind now, Polly," caused her to stop short and busy herself with the newcomer's bag and umbrella. "I changed my mind. Theodore, come and kiss me," answered Aunt Kipp briefly. "Yes'm," was the plaintive reply, and closing his eyes, Toady awaited his fate with fortitude. But the dreaded salute did not come, for Aunt Kipp exclaimed in alarm, "Mercy on us! Has the boy got the plague?" "No'm, it's paint and dirt and glue, and it won't come off," said Toady, stroking his variegated countenance with grateful admiration for the stains that saved him. "Go and wash this moment, sir. Thank heaven I've got no boys," cried Aunt Kipp, as if boys were some virulent disease which she had narrowly escaped. With a hasty peck at the lips of her two elder relatives, the old lady seated herself and slowly removed the awful bonnet, which in shape and hue much resembled a hearse hung with black crape. "I'm glad you are better," said Mary, reverently receiving the funeral headgear. "I'm not better," cut in Aunt Kipp. "I'm worse, much worse. My days are numbered. I stand on the brink of the tomb, and may drop at any moment." Toady's face was a study, and he glanced up at the old lady's florid countenance, down at the floor, as if in search of the above-mentioned brink, and looked unaffectedly anxious to see her drop. "Why don't you, then?" was on his lips, but a frown from Polly restrained him, and he sat himself down on the rug to contemplate the corpulent victim. "Have a cup of tea, aunt?" asked Mrs. Snow. "I will." "Lie down and rest a little?" suggested Polly. "I won't." "Can we do anything for you?" said both. "Take my things away and have dinner early." Both departed to perform these behests, and leaning back in her chair, Aunt Kipp reposed. "I say, what's a bore?" asked Toady from the rug, where he sat rocking meditatively to and fro, holding on by his shoestrings. "It's a kind of pig, very fierce, and folks are afraid of 'em," said Aunt Kipp, whose knowledge of natural history was limited. "Good for Polly, so you are," sang out the boy, with the hearty child's laugh so pleasant to most ears. "What do you mean, sir?" demanded the old lady, irefully poking at him with her umbrella. "Why, Polly said you were a bore," explained Toady with artless frankness. "You are fat, you know, and fierce sometimes, and folks are afraid of you. Good, wasn't it?" "Very. Mary is a nice, grateful, respectful, loving niece, and I shan't forget her, she may depend on that." And Aunt Kipp laughed grimly. "May she? Well, that's jolly now. She was afraid you wouldn't give her the money, so I'll tell her it's all right." And innocent Toady nodded approvingly. "Oh, she expects some of my money, does she?" "Course she does. Ain't you always saying you'll remember us in your will, because father was your favorite nephew and all that? I'll tell you a secret, if you won't let Polly know I spoke first. You'll find it out tonight, for you'd see Van and she were sweethearts in a minute." "Sweethearts!" cried Aunt Kipp, turning red in the face. "Yes'm. Van settled it last week, and Polly's been so happy ever since. Mother likes it, and I like it, for I'm fond of Van, though I do call him Baba, because he looks like a sheep. We all like it, and we'd all say so if we were not afraid of you. Mother and Polly, I mean. Of course, we men don't mind, but we don't want a fuss. You won't make one, will you now?" Anything more expressive of brotherly goodwill, persuasive frankness, and a placid consciousness of having fixed it, than Toady's dirty little face, it would be hard to find. Aunt Kipp eyed him so fiercely that even before she spoke, a dim suspicion that something was wrong began to dawn on his too confiding soul. "I don't like it, and I'll put a stop to it. I won't have any ridiculous babas in my family. If Mary counts on my money to begin housekeeping with, she'll find herself mistaken, for not one penny shall she have, married or single, and you may tell her so." Toady was so taken aback by this explosion that he let go his shoestrings, fell over with a crash, and lay flat, with shovel and tongs spread upon him like a pall. In rushed Mrs. Snow and Polly, to find the boy's spirits quite quenched for once, and Aunt Kipp in a towering passion. It all came out in one overwhelming flood of words, and Toady fled from the storm to wander round the house, a prey to the deepest remorse. The meekness of that boy at dinner time was so angelic that Mrs. Snow would have feared speedy translation for him if she had not been very angry. Polly's red eyes and Aunt Kipp's griffinesque expression of countenance weighed upon his soul so heavily that even Roly-Poly Pudding failed to assuage his trouble, and taking his mother into the china closet, he anxiously inquired if it was all up with Polly. "I'm afraid so, for Aunt vows she will make a new will tomorrow, and leave every penny to the Charitable Ragbag Society," sighed Mrs. Snow.
"I didn't mean to do it, I truly didn't. I thought I'd just give her a hint, as you say. She looked all right, and laughed when I told her about being a boar, and I thought she liked it. If she was a man, I'd thrash her for making Polly cry."
And Toady shook his fist at Aunt Kipp's umbrella, which was an immense relief to his perturbed spirit. "Bless the boy, I do believe he would," cried Mrs. Snow, watching the little turkey cock with maternal pride.
"You can't do that, so just be careful and not make any more mischief, dear."
"I'll try, Mother, but I'm always getting into scrapes with Aunt Kipp. She's worse than measles any day. Such an old aggrewater. Van's coming this afternoon. Won't he make her pleasant again?"
"Oh, dear, no. He will probably make things 10 times worse. He's so bashful and queer. I'm afraid our last chance is gone, dearie, and we must rub along as we have done."
One sniff of emotion burst from Toady, and for a moment he laid his head in the knife tray, overcome with disappointment and regret. But scorning to yield to unmanly tears, he was soon himself again, thrusting his beloved jackknife with 3 blades and a file into Polly's hand. He whispered brokenly,
"Keep it forever and ever. I'm awfully sorry."
Then, feeling that the magnitude of this sacrifice atoned for everything, he went to watch for Van, the forlorn hope to which he now clung. End of part 1. Shoes and Stockings, a collection of short stories by Louisa May Alcott. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Carolyn Francis. Aunt Kipp, Part 2, by Louisa May Alcott.
"Sophie, I'm surprised at your want of judgment. Do you really mean to let your girl marry this lamb? Why, the man's a fool," began Aunt Kipp after dinner, by way of opening a pleasant conversation with her relatives.
"Dear me, aunt, how can you know that when you never saw him?" mildly returned Mrs. Snow.
"I've heard of him, and that's enough for me. I've a deal of penetration in judging character, and I tell you Van Bahr Lam is a fool."
The amiable old lady thought this would rouse Polly, against whom her anger still burned hotly. But Polly also possessed penetration, and well knowing that contradiction would delight Aunt Kipp, she completely took the wind out of her sails by coolly remarking,
"I like fools."
"Bless my heart! What does the girl mean?" ejaculated Aunt Kipp.
"Just what I say. If Van is a fool, I prefer simpletons to wiseacres. I know he is shy and awkward, and does absurd things now and then, but I also know that he has the kindest heart that ever was, is unselfish, faithful, and loving, that he took good care of his old parents till they died, and never thought of himself while they needed him. He loves me dearly, will wait for me a 12 years if I say so, and work all his days to make me happy. He's a help and a comfort to Mother, a good friend to Toady, and I love and respect and am proud of him, though you do say he is a fool," cried Polly heartily.
"And you insist on marrying him?"
demanded Aunt Kipp.
"Yes, I do."
"Then I wish a carriage immediately," was the somewhat irrelevant reply.
"Why, Aunt, you don't mean to go so soon," cried Mrs. Snow, with a reproachful glance at the rebellious Polly.
"Far from it. I wish to see Judge Banks about altering my will," was the awful answer.
Polly's face fell. Her mother gave a despairing sigh. Toady, who had hovered about the door, uttered a suppressed whistle of dismay, and Mrs. Kipp looked about her with vengeful satisfaction.
"Get the big carry-all and old Bob, so the boy can drive. And all of you come, the trip will do you good."
It was like Aunt Kipp to invite her poor relations to go and nip their own noses off, as she elegantly expressed it. It was a party of pleasure that just suited her, for all the fun was on her side. She grew affable at once, was quite pressing in her invitation, regretted that Sophie was too busy to go, praised Polly's hat, and professed herself quite satisfied with "that dear boy" for a driver. The dear boy distorted his young countenance frightfully behind her back, but found a balm for every wound in the delight of being commander of the expedition. The big carry-all appeared, and with much creaking and swaying, Mrs. Kipp was got into the back seat, where the big bonnet gloomed like a thundercloud. Polly, in a high state of indignation, which only made her look 10 times prettier, sat in front with Toady, who was a sight to see as he drove off with his short legs planted against the boot, his elbows squared, and the big whip scientifically cracking now and then. Away they went, leaving poor Mrs. Snow to bewail herself dismally after she had smiled and nodded them out of sight.
"Don't go over any bridges or railroad crossings or by any sawmills," said the old lady, as if the town could be suddenly remodeled to suit her taste.
"Yes'm," returned Toady, with a crack which would have done honor to a French postillion. It was a fine day, and the young people would have enjoyed the ride in spite of the breakers ahead, if Aunt Kipp hadn't entertained the girl with a glowing account of the splendors of her own wedding, and aggravated the boy by frequent pokes and directions in the art of driving, of which she was, of course, profoundly ignorant. Polly couldn't restrain a tear or two in thinking of her own poor little prospects, and Toady was goaded to desperation.
"I'll give her a regular shaking up. It'll make her hold her tongue and do her good," he said to himself, as a stony hill sloped temptingly before him. A sly chuck, and some mysterious maneuver with the reins, and Bob started off at a brisk trot, as if he objected to the old lady as much as her mischievous little nephew.
"Hold him in! Keep a taunt rein! Mercy, he's running away!"
shrieked Aunt Kipp, or tried to shriek, for the bouncing and bumping jerked the words out of her mouth with ludicrous incoherency.
"I'm holding him, but he will go," said Toady, with a wicked triumph in his eye, as he glanced back at Polly.
The next minute the words were quite true, for as he spoke, two or three distracted hens flew squalling over the wall and scattered about, under, over, and before the horse, as only distracted hens could do. It was too much for Bob's nerves, and taking matters into his own hands, or feet, rather, he broke into a run and rattled the old lady over the stones with a velocity which left her speechless. Polly laughed, and Toady chuckled, as they caught glimpses of the awful bonnet vibrating wildly in the background, and felt the frantic clutchings of the old lady's hands. But both grew sober as a shrill car whistle sounded not far off, and Bob, as if possessed by an evil spirit,
turned suddenly into the road that led to the railroad crossing.
"That will do, Toady. Now pull up, for we can't get over in time," said Polly, glancing anxiously toward the rapidly approaching puffs of white smoke.
"I can't, Polly. I really can't," cried the boy, tugging with all his might and beginning to look scared.
Polly lent her aid, but Bob scarcely seemed to feel it, for he had been a racer once, and when his blood was up, he was hard to handle. His own good sense might have checked him if Aunt Kipp hadn't unfortunately recovered her voice at this crisis, and uttered a succession of the shrillest screams that ever saluted mortal ears. With a snort and a bound, Bob dashed straight on toward the crossing as the train appeared round the bend.
"Let me out! Let me out! Jump! Jump!" shrieked Aunt Kipp, thrusting her head out the window while she fumbled madly for the door handle.
"Oh, Toady, save us! Save us!" gasped Polly, losing her presence of mind, and dropping the reins to cling to her brother, with a woman's instinctive faith in the stronger sex. But Toady held on manfully, though his arms were nearly pulled off, for "never say die" was his motto, and the plucky little lad wouldn't show fear before the women.
"Don't howl, we'll do it! Hi, Bob!"
And with a savage slash of the whip, an exciting cry, a terrible reeling and rattling, they did do it, for Bob cleared the track at a breakneck pace, just in time for the train to sweep swiftly by behind them. Aunt Kipp dropped in a heap. Polly looked up at her brother with a look which he never forgot, and Toady tried to say stoutly, "It's all right," with lips that were white and dry in spite of himself.
"We shall smash up at the bridge," he muttered, as they tore through the town, where everyone obligingly shouted, waved their hats, and danced about on the sidewalks, doing nothing but add to Bob's fright and the party's danger. But Toady was wrong. They did not smash up at the bridge, for before they reached the perilous spot, one man had the sense to fly straight at the horse's head and hold on till the momentary check enabled others to lend a hand. The instant they were safe, Polly, like a regular heroine, threw herself into the arms of her disheveled preserver, who, of course, was Van, and would have refreshed herself with hysterics if the sight of Toady hadn't steadied her. The boy sat as stiff and rigid as a wooden figure till they took the reins from him. Then all the strength seemed to go out of him, and he leaned against his sister, as white and trembling as she, whispering with an irresistible sob,
"Oh, Polly, wasn't it horrid? Tell Mother I stood by you like a man. Do tell her that."
If anyone had had time or heart to laugh, they certainly would have done it when, after much groping, heaving, and hoisting, Mrs. Kipp was extracted and restored to consciousness, for a more ludicrously deplorable spectacle was seldom seen. Quite unhurt, though much shaken, the old lady insisted on believing herself to be dying, and kept the town in a ferment till three doctors had pronounced her perfectly well able to go home. Then the perversity of her nature induced her to comply, that she might have the satisfaction of dying on the way and proving herself in the right. Unfortunately, she did not expire, but having safely arrived, went to bed in high dudgeon, and led Polly and her mother a sad life of it for two weary days. Having heard of Toady's gallant behavior, she solemnly ordered him up to receive her blessing. But the sight of Aunt Kipp's rubicund visage, surrounded by the stiff frills of an immense nightcap, caused the irreverent boy to explode with laughter in his handkerchief, and to be hustled away by his mother before Aunt Kipp discovered the true cause of his convulsed appearance. Ah, poor dear, his feelings are too much for him. He sees my doom in my face, and is overcome by what you refuse to believe. I shan't forget that boy's devotion. Now leave me to the meditations befitting these solemn hours." Mrs. Snow retired, and Aunt Kipp tried to sleep, but the murmur of voices and the sound of stifled laughter in the next room disturbed her repose. "They are rejoicing over my approaching end, knowing that I haven't changed my will. Mercenary creatures, don't exult too soon. There's time yet," she muttered, and presently, unable to control her curiosity, she crept out of bed to listen and peep through the keyhole. Van Bahr Lamb did look rather like a sheep. He had a blonde, curly head, a long face, pale, mild eyes, a plaintive voice, and a general expression of innocent timidity strongly suggestive of animated mutton. But Baba was a trump, as Toady emphatically declared, and though everyone laughed at him, everyone liked him, and that is more than can be said of many saints and sages. He adored Polly, was dutifully kind to her mother, and had stood by T. Snow Jr. in many an hour of tribulation with fraternal fidelity. Though he had long blushed, sighed, and cast sheep eyes at the idol of his affections, only till lately had he dared to bleat forth his passion. Polly loved him because she couldn't help it, but she was proud and wouldn't marry till Aunt Kipp's money was hers, or at least a sure prospect of it. And now, even the prospect of a prospect was destroyed by the irrepressible Toady. They were talking of this as the old lady suspected, and, of course, the following conversation afforded her intense satisfaction. "It's a shame to torment us as she does, knowing how poor we are and how happy a little of her money would make us. I'm tired of being a slave to a cruel old woman just because she's rich. If it was not for a mother, I declare I'd wash my hands of her entirely and do the best I could for myself." "Hooray for Polly! I always said let her money go and be jolly without it," cried Toady, who, in his character of wounded hero, reposed with a lordly air on the sofa, enjoying the fragrance of the Oakdale dock with which his strained wrists were bandaged. "It's on your account, children, that I bear with Aunt's temper, as I do. I don't want anything for myself, but I really think she does owe it to your dear father, who was devoted to her while he lived, to provide for his children when he couldn't." After which remarkably spirited speech for her, Mrs. Snow dropped a tear and stitched away on a small trouser leg, which was suffering from a complicated compound fracture. "Don't you worry about me, Mother. I'll take care of myself and you, too," remarked Toady, with the cheery belief in impossibilities which makes youth so charming. "Now, Van, tell us what to do, for things have come to such a pass that we must either break away altogether or be galley slaves as long as Aunt Kipp lives," said Polly, who was a good deal excited about the matter. "Well, really, my dear, I don't know," hesitated Van, who did know what he wanted, but thought it might be selfish to urge it. "Have you tried to soften your aunt's heart?" he asked after a moment's meditation. "Good gracious, Van, she hasn't got any," cried Polly, who firmly believed it. "It's hossified," thoughtfully remarked Toady, quite unconscious of any approach to a joke till everyone giggled. "You've had hossification enough for a while, my lad," laughed Van. "Well, Polly, if the old lady has no heart, you'd better let her go, for people without hearts are not worth much." "That's a beautiful remark, Van, and a wise one. I just wish she could hear you make it, for she called you a fool,"
said Polly irefully. "Did she? Well, I don't mind, I'm used to it," returned Van placidly. And so he was, for Polly called him a goose every day of her life, and he enjoyed it immensely. "Then you think, dear, if we stopped worrying about Aunt and her money, and worked instead of waiting, that we shouldn't be any poorer and might be a great deal happier than we are now?" asked Polly, making a pretty little tableau as she put her hand through Van's arm and looked up at him with as much love, respect, and reliance as if he had been 6 feet tall, with the face of an Apollo and the manners of a Chesterfield. "Yes, my dear, I do, for it has troubled me a good deal to see you so badgered by that very uncomfortable old lady. Independence is a very nice thing, and poverty isn't half as bad as this sort of slavery. But you are not going to be poor, nor worry about anything. We'll just be married and take Mother and Toady home, and be as jolly as Griggs, and never think of Mrs. K. again, unless she loses her fortune, or gets sick, or comes to grief in any way. We'd lend her a hand then, wouldn't we, Polly?" And Van's mild face was pleasant to behold as he made the kindly proposition. "Well, we'd think of it," said Polly, trying not to relent, but feeling that she was going very fast.
"Let's do it," cried Toady, fired with the thought of privy conspiracy and rebellion. "Mother would be so comfortable with Polly, and I'd help Van in the store, when I've learned that confounded multiplication table," he added with a groan. "And if Aunt Kipp comes a-visiting, we'll just say, 'Not at home,' and let her trot off again."
"It sounds very nice, but Aunt will be dreadfully offended, and I don't wish to be ungrateful," said Mrs. Snow, brightening visibly.
"There's no ingratitude about it," cried Van. "She might have done everything to make you love and respect and admire her, and been a happy, useful, motherly old soul. But she didn't choose to, and now she must take the consequences. No one cares for her, because she cares for nobody. Her money's the plague of her life, and not a single heart will ache when she dies."
"Poor Aunt Kipp," said Polly softly. Mrs. Snow echoed the words, and for a moment all thought pitifully of the woman whose life had given so little happiness, whose age had won so little reverence, and whose death would cause so little regret. Even Toady had a kind thought for her as he broke the silence, saying soberly,
"You'd better put tails on my jackets, Mother. Then the next time we get run away with, Aunt Kipp will have something to hold on by."
It was impossible to help laughing at the recollection of the old lady clutching at the boy till he had hardly a button left, and at the paternal air with which he now proposed a much-desired change of costume, as if intent on Aunt Kipp's future accommodation. Under cover of the laugh, the old lady stole back to bed, wide awake, and with subjects enough to meditate upon now. The shaking up had certainly done her good, for somehow the few virtues she possessed came to the surface, and the mental shower bath just received had produced a salutary change. Polly wouldn't have doubted her aunt's possession of a heart if she could have known the pain and loneliness that made it ache as the old woman crept away. And Toady wouldn't have laughed if he had seen the tears on the face between the big frills as Aunt Kipp laid it on the pillow, muttering drearily, "I might have been a happy, useful woman, but I didn't choose to, and now it's too late." It was too late to be all she might have been, for the work of 70 selfish years couldn't be undone in a minute. But with regret rose the sincere wish to earn a little love before the end came, and the old perversity gave a relish to the reformation, for even while she resolved to do the just and generous thing, she said to herself, "They say I've got no heart. I'll show 'em that I have. They don't want my money. I'll make 'em take it. They turn their backs on me. I'll just render myself so useful and agreeable that they can't do without me." End of part 2. Shoes and Stockings, a collection of short stories by Louisa May Alcott. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Carolyn Francis. Aunt Kipp, Part 3, by Louisa May Alcott. Aunt Kipp sat bolt upright in the parlor, hemming a small handkerchief adorned with a red ship surrounded by a border of green monkeys. Toady suspected that this elegant article of dress was intended for him, and yearned to possess it. So, taking advantage of his mother's and Polly's absence, he strolled into the room, and, seating himself on a high, hard chair, folded his hands, crossed his legs, and asked for a story with a thirsting-for-knowledge air which little boys wear in the moral storybooks. Now, Aunt Kipp had one soft place in her heart, though it was partially ossified, as she very truly declared, and Toady was enshrined therein. She thought there never was such a child, and loved him as she had done his father before him, though the rack wouldn't have forced her to confess it. She scolded, snubbed, and predicted he'd come to a bad end in public. But she forgave his naughtiest pranks, always brought him something when she came, and privately intended to make his future comfortable with half of her fortune. There was a dash and daring, a generosity and integrity about the little fellow that charmed her. Sophie was weak and low-spirited, Polly pretty and headstrong, and Aunt Kipp didn't think much of either of them. But Toady defied, distracted, and delighted her, and to Toady she clung, as the one sunshiny thing in her sour, selfish old age. When he made his demure request, she looked at him, and her eyes began to twinkle, for the child's purpose was plainly seen in the loving glances cast upon the pictorial pocket handkerchief. "A story? Yes, I'll tell you one about a little boy who had a kind old, grandma. She was rich and hadn't made up her mind who she'd leave her money to. She was fond of the boy, a deal fonder than he deserved, for he was as mischievous a monkey as any that ever lived in a tree, with a curly tail. He put pepper in her snuff-box. Here, Toady turned scarlet. He cut up her best frisette to make a mane for his rocking-horse. Toady opened his mouth impulsively, but shut it again without betraying himself. He repeated rude things to her and called her an old agar-water. Here, Toady wriggled in his chair and gave a little gasp. "If you are tired, I won't go on," observed Aunt Kipp mildly. "I'm not tired, em. It's a very interesting story," replied Toady, with a gravity that nearly upset the old lady. "Well, in spite of all this, that kind, good, forgiving grandma left that bad boy $20,000 when she died. What do you think of that?" asked Aunt Kipp, pausing suddenly with her sharp eye on him. I think she was a regular dear," cried Toady, holding on to the chair with both hands, as if that climax rather took him off his legs. "And what did the boy do about it?" continued Aunt Kipp curiously. "He bought a velocipede, and gave his sister half, and paid his mother's rent,
and put a splendid marble sherrikin over the old lady and had a jolly good time and—" "What in the world is a cherrikin?" laughed Aunt Kipp, as Toady paused for breath. "Why, don't you know? It's an angel crying, or pointing up, or flapping his wings. They have them over graves, and I'll give you the biggest one I can find when you die, but I'm not in a very great hurry to have you." "Thank ye, dear. I'm in no hurry myself. But, Toady, the boy did wrong in giving his sister half. She didn't deserve any. And the grandma left word she wasn't to have a penny of it."
"Really?" cried the boy with a troubled face.
"Yes, really. If he gave her any, he lost it all. The old lady said so." "Now what do you think?" asked Aunt Kipp, who found it impossible to pardon Polly, perhaps because she was young and pretty and much beloved. Toady's eyes kindled, and his red cheeks grew redder still as he cried out defiantly,
"I think she was a selfish pig, don't you?"
"No, I don't, sir. And I'm sure that little boy wasn't such a fool as to lose the money. He minded his grandma's wishes and kept it all."
"No, he didn't," roared Toady,
tumbling off his chair in great excitement. "He just threw it out the winder and smashed the old cherrikin all to bits." Aunt Kipp dropped her work with a shrill squeak, for she thought the boy was dangerous as he stood before her, sparring away at nothing as the only vent for his indignation.
"It isn't an interesting story," he cried, "and I won't hear any more, and I won't have your money if I mayn't go halves with Polly. And I'll work to earn more than that, and we'll all be jolly together, and you may give your 20,000 to the old ragbags, and so I tell you, Aunt Kipp."
"Why, Toady, my boy, what's the matter?" cried a mild voice at the door, as young Lamb came trotting up to the rescue.
"Never you mind, Baba. I shan't do it. And it's a mean shame Polly can't have half. Then she could marry you and be so happy," blubbered Toady, running to try to hide his tears of disappointment in the coat skirts of his friend.
"Mr. Lamb, I suppose you are that misguided young man?" asked Aunt Kipp, as if it was a personal insult to herself.
"Vanbar Lamb, ma'am, if you please."
"Yes, thank you," murmured Baba, bowing, blushing, and rumpling his curly fleece in bashful trepidation.
"Don't thank me," cried the old lady. "I'm not going to give you anything. Far from it. I object to you altogether. What business have you to come courting my niece?"
"Because I love her, ma'am," returned Van with unexpected spirit.
"No, you don't. You want her money, or rather my money. She depends on it. But you'll both be disappointed, for she won't have a penny of it," cried Aunt Kipp, who, in spite of her good resolutions, found it impossible to be amiable all at once.
"I'm glad of it," burst out Van, indignant at her accusation. "I didn't want Polly for the money. I always doubted if she got it, and I never wished her to make herself a slave to anybody. I've got enough for all if we're careful, and when my share of the Vanbar property comes, we shall live in clover."
"What's that? What property are you talking of?" demanded Aunt Kipp, pricking up her ears.
"The great Vanbar estate, ma'am. There has been a long lawsuit about it, but it's nearly settled, and there isn't much doubt that we shall get it. I am the last of our branch, and my share will be a large one."
"Oh, indeed! I wish you joy," said Aunt Kipp, with sudden affability, for she adored wealth, like a few other persons in the world.
"But suppose you don't get it, how then?"
"Then I shall try to be contented with my salary of 2,000, and make Polly as happy as I can. Money doesn't always make people happy or agreeable, I find. and Van looked at Aunt Kipp in a way that would have made her hair stand erect if she had possessed any. She stared at him a moment, then, obeying one of the odd whims that made an irascible weathercock of her, she said abruptly,
"If you had capital, should you go into business for yourself, Mr. Lambkin?"
"Yes, ma'am, at once," replied Van promptly.
"Suppose you lost the Van Bahr money, and someone offered you a tidy little sum to start with. Would you take it?"
"It would depend upon who made the offer, ma'am," said Van, looking more like a sheep than ever, as he stood staring in blank surprise.
"Suppose it was me, wouldn't you take it?" asked Aunt Kipp blandly, for the new fancy pleased her.
"No, thank you, ma'am," said Van decidedly.
"And why not, pray?" cried the old lady with a shrillness that made him jump, and Toady back to the door precipitately.
"Because, if you'll excuse my speaking plainly, I think you owe anything you may have to spare to your niece, Mrs. Snow." And having freed his mind, Van joined Toady, ready to fly if necessary.
"You're an idiot, sir," began Aunt Kipp, in a rage again.
"Thank you, ma'am," and Van actually laughed and bowed in return for the compliment.
"Hold your tongue, sir," snapped the old lady. "You're a fool, and Sophy is another. She's no strength of mine, no sense about anything, and would make ducks and drakes of my money in less than no time if I gave it to her, as I've thought of doing."
"Mrs. Kipp, you forget who you are speaking to. Mrs. Snow's sons love and respect her if you don't, and they won't hear anything untrue or unkind said of a good woman, a devoted mother, and an almost friendless widow." Van wasn't a dignified man at all, but as he said that with a sudden flash of his mild eyes, there was something in his face and manner that daunted Aunt Kipp more than the small fist belligerently shaken at her from behind the sofa. The poor old soul was cross and worried and ashamed of herself, and being as feeble-minded as Sophy in many respects, she suddenly burst into tears, and, covering her face with the gay handkerchief, cried as if bent on flooding the red ship in a sea of salt water without delay.
"I'm a poor, lonely, abused old woman," she moaned, with a green monkey at each eye. "No one loves me or minds me or thanks me when I want to help 'em. My money's only a worryment and a burden, and I don't know what to do with it, for people I don't want to leave it to ought to have it, and people I do like won't take it. Oh, dearie me, what shall I do? What shall I do?"
"Shall I tell you, ma'am?" asked Van gently, for though she was a very provoking old lady, he pitied and wished to help her. A nod and a gurgle seemed to give consent, and boldly advancing, Van said with blush and a stammer, but a very hearty voice,
"I think, ma'am, if you'd do the right thing with your money, you'd be at ease and find it saved a deal of worry all round. Give it to Mrs. Snow. She deserves it, poor lady, for she's had a hard time and done her duty faithfully. Don't wait till you are, that is, till you, well, till you in point of fact die, ma'am. Give it now and enjoy the happiness it will make. Give it kindly. Let them see you're glad to do it, and I am sure you'll find them grateful. I'm sure you won't be lonely any more, or feel that you are not loved and thanked. Try it, ma'am, just try it," cried Van, getting excited by the picture he drew. "And I give you my word I'll do my best to respect and love you like a son, ma'am." He knew that he was promising a great deal, but for Polly's sake, he felt that he could make even that Herculean effort. Aunt Kipp was surprised and touched, but the contrary old lady couldn't make up her mind to yield so soon, and wouldn't have done it if Toady hadn't taken her by storm. Having a truly masculine horror of tears, a very tender heart under his tailless jacket, and being much tumbled up and down in his own mind by the events of the week, the poor little lad felt nerved to attempt any novel enterprise, even that of voluntarily embracing Aunt Kipp. First, a grimy little hand came on her shoulder as she sat sniffing behind the handkerchief. Then, peeping out, she saw an apple-cheeked face very near her own, with eyes full of pity, penitence, and affection. And then she heard a choky little voice say earnestly, "Don't cry, Auntie. I'm sorry I was rude. Please be good to Mother and Polly, and I'll love and take care of you and stand by you all my life. Yes, I'll kiss you. I will, by George." And with one promiscuous plunge, the Spartan boy cast himself into her arms. That finished Aunt Kipp. She hugged him close and cried out with a salute that went off like a pistol shot, "Oh, my dear, this is better than a dozen cherrikins." When Toady emerged, somewhat flushed and tumbled, Mrs. Snow, Polly, and Van were looking on with faces full of wonder, doubt, and satisfaction. To be an object of interest was agreeable to Aunt Kipp, and as her old heart was really softened, she met them with a gracious smile and extended the olive branch generally. "Sophie, I shall give my money to you at once and entirely, only asking that you'll let me stay with you when Polly's gone. I'll do my best to be agreeable, and you'll bear with me because I'm a cranky, solitary old woman, and I loved your husband." Mrs. Snow hugged her on the spot, and gushed, of course, murmuring thanks, welcomes, and promises in one grateful burst. "Polly, I forgive you. I consent to your marriage, and will provide your wedding finery. Mr. Lamb, you are not a fool, but a very excellent young man. I thank you for saving my life, and I wish you well with all my heart. You needn't say anything. I'm far from strong, and all this agitation is shortening my life." Polly and Van shook her hand heartily and beamed upon each other like a pair of infatuated turtle doves with good prospects. "Toady, you are as near an angel as a boy can be. Put a name to whatever you most wish for in the world, and it's yours," said Aunt Kipp, dramatically waving the rest away. With his short legs wide apart, his hands behind him, and his rosy face as round and radiant as a rising sun, Toady stood before the fire, surveying the scene with the air of a man who had successfully carried through a difficult and dangerous undertaking, and wasn't proud. His face brightened, then fell, as he heaved a sigh and answered with a shake of his curly head, "You can't give me what I want most. There are three things, and I've got to wait for them all." "Gracious me, what are they?" cried the old lady good-naturedly, for she felt better already. "A mustache, a beaver, and a sweetheart," answered Toady, with his eyes fixed wistfully on Baba, who possessed all these blessings, and was particularly enjoying the latter at that moment. How Aunt Kipp did laugh at this early budding of romance in her pet, and all the rest joined her, for Toady's sentimental air was irresistible. "You precocious chick! I dare say you will have them all before we know where we are. Never mind, dearie. You shall have my little watch and the silver-headed cane with a boar's head on it," answered the old lady in high good humor. "You needn't blush, dear. I don't bear malice, so let's forget and forgive. I shall settle things tomorrow and have a free mind. You are welcome to my money,
and I hope I shall live to see you all enjoy it." So she did, for she lived to see Sophy plump, cheery, and carefree, Polly surrounded by a flock of lambkins, Van in possession of a generous slice of the Van Bar fortune, Toady reveling in the objects of his desire, and best of all, she lived to find that it is never too late to make oneself useful, happy, and beloved. End of Part 3. End of Aunt Kipp by Louisa May Alcott. Shoes and Stockings, a collection of short stories by Louisa May Alcott. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Carolyn Francis. Kitty's Class Day by Louisa May Alcott. A Stitch in Time Saves 9.
"Oh, Pris, Pris, I'm really going. Here's the invitation. Rough paper, chapel spreads, Lyceum Hall, everything splendid, and Jack to take care of me." As Kitty burst into the room and performed a rapturous pasal, waving the cards over her head, Sister Priscilla looked up from her work with a smile of satisfaction on her quiet face.
"Who invites you, dear?"
"Why, Jack, of course. Dear old cousin Jack. Nobody else ever thinks of me or cares whether I have a bit of pleasure now and then. Isn't he kind? Mayn't I go? And, oh, Pris, what shall I wear?"
Kitty paused suddenly, as if the last all-important question had a solemnizing effect upon both mind and body.
"Why, your white muslin, silk sack, and new hat, of course," began Pris with an air of surprise. But Kitty broke in impetuously. "I'll never wear that old muslin again. It's full of darns, up to my knees, and all out of fashion. So is my sack. And as for my hat, though it does well enough here, it would be absurd for class day."
"You don't expect an entirely new suit for this occasion, do you?" asked Pris anxiously.
"Yes, I do. And I'll tell you how I mean to get it. I've planned everything, for though I hardly dreamed of going, I amused myself by thinking how I could manage if I did get invited.
Let us hear." And Pris took up her work with an air of resignation.
"First, my dress," began Kitty, perching herself on the arm of the sofa and entering into the subject with enthusiasm. "I've got the $10 Grandpa sent me, and with 8 of it, I'm going to buy Lizzie King's organdy muslin. She got it in Paris, but her aunt unfortunately, died, so she can't wear it, and wants to get rid of it. She is bigger than I am, you know, so there is enough for a little mantle or sack, for it isn't made up. The skirt is cut off and gored, with a splendid train. My dear, you don't mean you're going to wear one of those absurd new-fashioned dresses?" exclaimed Pris, lifting hands and eyes.
"I do. Nothing would induce me to go to class day without a train. It's been the desire of my heart to have one, and now I will, if I never have another gown to my back," returned Kitty with immense decision.
Pris shook her head and said, "Go on," as if prepared for any extravagance after that.
"We can make it ourselves," continued Kitty, "and trim it with the same. It's white with blue stripes and daisies in the stripes. The loveliest thing you ever saw, and can't be got here. So simple, yet distingué. I know you'll like it. Next, my bonnet." Here the solemnity of Kitty's face and manner was charming to behold. "I shall make it out of one of my new illusion undersleeves. I've never worn them,
and the puffed part will be a plenty for a little flyaway bonnet of the latest style. I've got blue ribbons to tie it with, and have only to look up some daisies for the inside. With my extra $2, I shall buy my gloves and pay my fares. And there I am, all complete. She looked so happy, so pretty, and full of girlish satisfaction, that Sister Pris couldn't bear to disturb the little plan, much as she disapproved of it. They were poor, and every penny had to be counted. There were plenty of neighbors to gossip and criticize, and plenty of friends to make disagreeable remarks on any unusual extravagance. Pris saw things with the prudent eyes of 30, but Kitty with the romantic eyes of 17. And the elder sister, in the kindness of her heart, had no wish to sadden life to those bright young eyes, or deny the child a harmless pleasure. She sewed thoughtfully for a minute, then looked up, saying, with a smile that always assured Kitty the day was won, "Get your things together, and we will see what can be done. But remember, dear, that it is both bad taste and bad economy for poor people to try to ape the rich." "You're a perfect angel, Pris, so don't moralize. I'll run and get the dress, and we'll begin at once, for there is much to do and only 2 days to do it in." And Kitty skipped away singing Laranger Horatus at the top of her voice. Priscilla soon found that the girl's head was completely turned by the advice and example of certain fashionable young neighbors. It was in vain for Pris to remonstrate and warn. "Just this once, let me do as others do, and thoroughly enjoy myself," pleaded Kitty. And Pris yielded, saying to herself, "She shall have her wish, and if she learns a lesson, neither time nor money will be lost." So they snipped and sewed and planned and pieced, going through all the alternations of despair and triumph, worry and satisfaction, which women undergo when a new suit is under way. Company kept coming, for news of Kitty's expedition had flown abroad, and her young friends must just run in to hear about it, and ask what she was going to wear, while Kitty was so glad and proud to tell and show and enjoy her little triumph that many half hours were wasted, and the second day found much still to do. The lovely muslin didn't hold out, and Kitty sacrificed the waist to the train, for a train she must have, or the whole thing would be an utter failure. A little sack was eked out, however, and when the frills were on, it was ravishing, as Kitty said, with a sigh of mingled delight and fatigue. The gored skirt was a fearful job, as anyone who has ever plunged into the mysteries will testify, and before the facing, even experienced Pris quailed. The bonnet also was a trial, for when the lace was on, it was discovered that the ribbons didn't match the dress. Here was a catastrophe. Kitty frantically rummaged the house, the shops, the stores of her friends, and rummaged in vain. There was no time to send to the city, and despair was about to fall on Kitty when Pris rescued her by quietly making one of the small sacrifices, which were easy to her because her life was spent for others. Someone suggested a strip of blue illusion, and that could be got. But alas, Kitty had no money, for the gloves were already bought. Pris heard the lamentations, and giving up fresh ribbons for herself, pulled her sister out of a slough of despond with 2 yards of heavenly tulle. "Now the daisies, and oh, dear me, not one can I find in this poverty-stricken town," sighed Kitty, prinking at the glass and fervently hoping that nothing would happen to her complexion overnight. "I see plenty just like those on your dress," answered Pris, nodding toward the meadow full of young white weed. "Pris, you're a treasure! I'll wear real ones. They keep well, I know, and are so common I can refresh my bonnet anywhere. It's a splendid idea!"
Away rushed Kitty to return with an apron full of American daisies. A pretty cluster was soon fastened just over the left-hand frizzle of bright hair, and the little bonnet was complete.
"Now, Pris, tell me how I look," cried Kitty, as she swept into the room late that afternoon in full gala costume.
It would have been impossible for the primmest, the sourest, or the most sensible creature in the world to say that it wasn't a pretty sight. The long train, the big chignon, the apology for a bonnet, were all ridiculous. No one could deny that. But youth, beauty, and a happy heart made even those absurdities charming. The erect young figure gave an air to the crisp folds of the delicate dress. The bright eyes and fresh cheeks under the lace rosette made one forget its size, and the rippling brown hair won admiration in spite of the ugly bunch which disfigured the girl's head. The little jacket set divinely, the new gloves were as immaculate as white kids could be, and to crown all, Lizzie King, in a burst of generosity, lent Kitty the blue and white Paris sunshade which she couldn't use herself.
"Now I could die content. I'm perfect in all respects, and I know Jack won't be ashamed of me. I really owe it to him to look my best, you know, and that's why I'm so particular," said Kitty in an apologetic tone, as she began to lay away her finery.
"I hope you will enjoy every minute of the time, dearie. Don't forget to finish running up the facing. I've basted it carefully, and would do it if my head didn't ache so. I really can't hold it up any longer," answered Pris, who had worked like a disinterested bee while Kitty had flown about like a distracted butterfly.
"Go and lie down, you dear, kind soul, and don't think of my nonsense again," said Kitty, feeling remorseful, till Pris was completely asleep, when she went to her room and reveled in her finery till bedtime. So absorbed was she in learning to manage her train gracefully that she forgot the facing till very late. Then, being worn out with work and worry, she did what girls are too apt to do, stuck a pin here and there, and, trusting to Priscilla's careful bastings, left it as it was, retiring to dream of a certain Horace Fletcher, whose aristocratic elegance had made a deep impression upon her during the few evenings she had seen him. Nothing could have been lovelier than the morning, and few hearts happier than Kitty's, as she arrayed herself with the utmost care and waited in solemn state for the carriage, for muslin trains and dewy roads were incompatible, and one luxury brought another.
"My goodness, where did she get that stylish suit?" whispered Miss Smith to Miss Jones, as Kitty floated into the station with all sail set, finding it impossible to resist the temptation to astonish certain young ladies who had snubbed her in times past, which snubs had rankled, and were now avenged.
"I looked everywhere for a muslin for today and couldn't find any I liked, so I was forced to wear my mauve silk," observed Miss Smith, complacently settling the silvery folds of her dress. "It's very pretty, but one ruins a silk at class day, you know. I thought this organdy would be more comfortable and appropriate this warm day. A friend brought it from Paris, and it's like one the Princess of Wales wore at the great flower show this year," returned Kitty, with the air of a young lady who had all her dresses from Paris, and was intimately acquainted with the royal family. Those girls were entirely extinguished by this stroke, and hadn't a word to say for themselves, while Kitty casually mentioned Horace Fletcher, Lyceum Hall, and Cousin Jack, for they had only a little freshman brother to boast of, and were not going to Lyceum Hall. As she stepped out of the cars at Cambridge, Jack opened his honest blue eyes and indulged in a low whistle of astonishment. For if there was anything he especially hated, it was the trains, chignons, and tiny bonnets then in fashion. He was very fond of Kitty, and prided himself on being able to show his friends a girl who was charming and yet not overdressed. "She has made a regular guy of herself. I won't tell her so, and the dear little soul shall have a jolly time in spite of her fuss and feathers. But I do wish she had let her hair alone and worn that pretty hat of hers." As this thought passed through Jack's mind, he smiled and bowed, and made his way among the crowd, whispering as he drew his cousin's arm through his own, "Why, Kitty, you're got up regardless of expense, aren't you? I'm so glad you came. We'll have a rousing good time, and you shall see all the fun." "Oh, thank you, Jack. Do I look nice, really? I tried to be a credit to you and Pris, and I did have such a job of it. I'll make you laugh over it sometime. A carriage for me? Bless us, how fine we are!" And Kitty stepped in, feeling that only one thing more was needed to make her cup overflow. That one thing was speedily vouchsafed, for before her skirts were smoothly settled, Jack called out in his hearty way, "How are you, Fletcher? If you are bound for chapel, I'll take you up." "Thanks. Good morning, Miss Heath." It was all done in an instant, and the next thing Kitty knew, she was rolling away with the elegant Horace sitting opposite. How little it takes to make a young girl happy! A pretty dress, sunshine, and somebody opposite, and they are blessed. Kitty's face glowed and dimpled with pleasure as she glanced about her, especially when she, sitting in state with two gentlemen all to herself, passed those girls walking in the dust with a beardless boy. She felt that she could forgive past slights, and did so with a magnanimous smile and bow. Both Jack and Fletcher had graduated the year before, but still took an interest in their old haunts and patronized the fellows who were not yet through the mill, at least the seniors and juniors. Of softs and freshs, they were sublimely unconscious. Greeted by frequent slaps on the shoulder and hearty, "How are you, old fellows?" they piloted Kitty to a seat in the chapel. An excellent place, but the girl's satisfaction was marred by Fletcher's desertion, and she could not see anything attractive about the dashing young lady in the pink bonnet to whom he devoted himself, because she was a stranger, Kitty said. Everybody knows what goes on in the chapel. After the fight and scramble are over, the rustle and buzz, the music, the oratory and the poem, during which the men cheer and the girls simper, the professors yawn, and the poet's friends pronounce him a second Longfellow. Then the closing flourishes, the grand crush, and general scattering. Then the fun really begins as far as the young folks are concerned. They don't mind swarming up and downstairs in a solid phalanx. They can enjoy half a dozen courses of salad, ice and strawberries, with stout gentlemen crushing their feet, anxious mammas sticking sharp elbows into their sides, and absent-minded tutors walking over them. They can flirt vigorously in a torrid atmosphere of dinner, dust, and din, can smile with hot coffee running down their backs, small avalanches of ice cream descending upon their best bonnets, and sandwiches, butter side down, reposing on their delicate silks. They know that it is a costly rapture, but they carefully refrain from thinking of the morrow, and energetically illustrate the Yankee maxim, which bids us enjoy ourselves in our early bloom. Kitty did have a rousing good time, for Jack was devoted, taking her everywhere, showing her everything, feeding and fanning her and festooning her train with untiring patience. How many forcible expressions he mentally indulged in as he walked on that unlucky train we will not record. He smiled, and skipped and talked of treading on flowers in a way that would have charmed Kitty if someone else had not been hovering about the Daisy, as Fletcher called her. After he returned, she neglected Jack, who took it coolly and was never in the way unless she wanted him. For the first time in her life, Kitty deliberately flirted. The little coquetries, which are as natural to a gay young girl as her laughter, were all in full play, and had she gone no further, no harm would have been done. But, excited by the example of those about her, Kitty tried to enact the fashionable young lady, and, like most novices, she overdid the part. Quite forgetting her cousin, she tossed her head, twirled her fan, gave affected little shrieks at college jokes, and talked college slang in a way that convulsed Fletcher, who enjoyed the fun immensely. Jack saw it all, shook his head, and said nothing, but his face grew rather sober as he watched Kitty, flushed, disheveled, and breathless, whirling round Lyceum Hall on the arm of Fletcher, who danced divinely, as all the girls agreed. Jack had proposed going, but Kitty had frowned, so he fell back, leaving her to listen and laugh, blush and shrink a little at her partner's flowery compliments and admiring glances. "If she stands that long, she's not the girl I took her for," thought Jack, beginning to lose patience. "She doesn't look like my little Kitty, and somehow I don't feel half so fond and proud of her as usual. I know one thing. My daughters shall never be seen knocking about in that style." As if the thought suggested the act, Jack suddenly assumed an air of parental authority, and, arresting his cousin as she was about to begin again, he said, in a tone she had never heard before, "I promised Pris to take care of you, so I shall carry you off to rest and put yourself to rights after this game of romps. I advise you to do the same, Fletcher, or give your friend in the pink bonnet a turn." Kitty took Jack's arm pettishly, but glanced over her shoulder with such an inviting smile that Fletcher followed, feeling very much like a top, in danger of tumbling down the instant he stopped spinning. As she came out, Kitty's face cleared, and, assuming her sprightliest air, she spread her plumage and prepared to descend with effect, for a party of uninvited Paris stood at the gate of this paradise, casting longing glances at the forbidden splendors within. Slowly, that all might see her, Kitty sailed down with Horace, the debonair, in her wake, and was just thinking to herself, "Those girls won't get over this very soon, I fancy," when all in one moment she heard Fletcher exclaim wrathfully, "Hang the flounces!" She saw a very glossy black hat come skipping down the steps, felt a violent twitch backward, and, to save herself from a fall, sat down on the lower step with most undignified haste. It was impossible for the bystanders to help laughing, for there was Fletcher hopping wildly about, with one foot nicely caught in a muslin loop, and there sat Kitty, longing to run away and hide herself, yet perfectly helpless, while everyone tittered. Miss Jones and Miss Smith laughed shrilly, and the despised little freshman completed her mortification by a feeble joke about Kitty Heath's new man-trap. It was only an instant, but it seemed an hour before Fletcher freed her, and, snatching up the dusty beaver, left her with a flushed countenance and an abrupt bow. If it hadn't been for Jack, Kitty would have burst into tears then and there, so terrible was the sense of humiliation which oppressed her. For his sake she controlled herself, and, bundling up her torn train, set her teeth, stared straight before her, and let him lead her in dead silence to a friend's room nearby. There he locked the door, and began to comfort her by making light of the little mishap. But Kitty cried so tragically that he was at his wit's end, till the ludicrous side of the affair struck her, and she began to laugh hysterically, with a vague idea that vigorous treatment was best for that feminine ailment. Jack was about to empty the contents of an ice pitcher over her, when she arrested him by exclaiming incoherently, "Oh, don't! It was so funny! How can you laugh, you cruel boy? I'm disgraced forever! Take me home to Pris! Oh, take me home to Pris!" "I will, my dear, I will. But first let me write you up a bit.
"You look as if you had been hazed, upon my life you do." And Jack laughed, in spite of himself, at the wretched little object before him, for dust, dancing, and the downfall produced a ruinous spectacle. That broke Kitty's heart, and spreading her hands before her face, she was about to cry again, when the sad sight which met her eyes dispelled the gathering tears. The new gloves were both split up the middle, and very dirty with clutching at the steps as she went down. "Never mind, you can wash them," said Jack soothingly. "I paid $1.50 for them, and they can't be washed," groaned Kitty. "Oh, hang the gloves! I meant your hands!" cried Jack, trying to keep sober. "No matter for my hands. I mourn my gloves. But I won't cry any more, for my head aches now so I can hardly see." And Kitty threw off her bonnet, as if even that airy trifle hurt her. Seeing how pale she looked, Jack tenderly suggested a rest on the old sofa and a wet handkerchief on her hot forehead, while he got the good landlady to send her up a cup of tea. As Kitty rose to comply, she glanced at her dress, and clasping her hands, exclaimed tragically, "The facing! The fatal facing! That made all the mischief, for if I'd sewed it up last night, it wouldn't have ripped today. If it hadn't ripped, Fletcher wouldn't have got his foot in it. I shouldn't have made an object of myself, and he wouldn't have gone off in a rage, and who knows what might have happened." "Bless the what's-its-name if it has settled him," cried Jack. "He is a contemptible fellow not to stay and help you out of the scrape he got you into. Follow his lead and don't trouble yourself about him." "Well, he was rather absurd today, I allow, but he has got handsome eyes and hands, and he does dance like an angel," sighed Kitty, as she pinned up the treacherous loop which had brought destruction to her little castle in the air. "Handsome eyes, white hands, and angelic feet don't make a man. Wait till you can do better, Kit." With an odd, grave look that rather startled Kitty, Jack vanished, to return presently with a comfortable cup of tea and a motherly old lady to help repair damages and soothe her by the foolish little purrings and pattings so grateful to female nerves after a flurry. "I'll come back and take you out to see the dance round the tree when you've had a bit of a rest," said Jack, vibrating between door and sofa, as if it wasn't easy to get away. "Oh, I couldn't," cried Kitty, with a shudder at the bare idea of meeting anyone. "I can't be seen again tonight. Let me stay here till my train goes." "I thought it had gone already," said Jack, with an irrepressible twinkle of the eye that glanced at the draggled dress sweeping the floor. "How can you joke about it?" And the girl's reproachful eyes filled with tears of shame. "I know I've been very silly, Jack, but I've had my punishment, and I don't need any more. To feel that you despise me is worse than all the rest." She ended with a little sob, and turned her face away to hide the trembling of her lips. At that, Jack flushed up, his eyes shone, and he stooped suddenly as if to make some impetuous reply. But, remembering the old lady, who by the by was discreetly looking out of the window, he put his hands in his pockets and strolled out of the room. "I've lost them both by this day's folly," thought Kitty, and Mrs. Brown departed with the teacup. "I don't care for Fletcher, for I dare say he didn't mean half he said, and I was only flattered because he is rich and handsome, and the girls glorify him. But I shall miss Jack, for I've known and loved him all my life. How good he's been to me today! So patient, careful, and kind, though he must have been ashamed of me. I know he didn't like my dress, but he never said a word and stood by me through everything. Oh, I wish I'd minded Pris. Then he would have respected me, at least. I wonder if he ever will again." Following a sudden impulse, Kitty sprang up, locked the door,
and then proceeded to destroy all her little vanities as far as possible. She smoothed out her crimps with a wet and ruthless hand, fastened up her pretty hair in the simple way Jack liked, gave her once cherished bonnet a spiteful shake as she put it on, and utterly extinguished it with a big blue veil. She looped up her dress, leaving no vestige of the now hateful train, and did herself up uncompromisingly in the Quakerish gray shawl Pris had insisted on her taking for the evening. Then she surveyed herself with pensive satisfaction, saying, in the tone of one bent on resolutely mortifying the flesh, "Neat, but not gaudy. I'm a fright, but I deserve it. And it's better than being a peacock." Kitty had time to feel a little friendless and forlorn, sitting there alone as twilight fell, and amused herself by wondering if Fletcher would come to inquire about her, or show any further interest in her. Yet, when the sound of a manly tramp approached, she trembled lest it should be the victim of the fatal facing. The door opened, and with a sigh of relief, she saw Jack come in, bearing a pair of new gloves in one hand, and a great bouquet of June roses in the other.
"How good of you to bring me these! They are more refreshing than oceans of tea. You know what I like, Jack. Thank you very much," cried Kitty, sniffing at her roses with grateful rapture.
"And you know what I like," returned Jack, with an approving glance at the altered figure before him.
"I'll never do so any more," murmured Kitty, wondering why she felt bashful all of a sudden, when it was only Cousin Jack.
"Now put on your gloves, dear, and come out and hear the music. Your train doesn't go for 2 hours yet, and you mustn't mope here all that time," said Jack, offering his second gift.
"How did you know my size?" asked Kitty, putting on the gloves in a hurry. For though Jack had called her dear for years, the little word had a new sound tonight.
"I guessed. No, I didn't. I had the old ones with me. They are no good now, are they?" And too honest to lie, Jack tried to speak carelessly, though he turned red in the dusk, well knowing that the dirty little gloves were folded away in his left breast pocket at that identical moment.
"Oh, dear, no! These fit nicely. I'm ready if you don't mind going with such a fright," said Kitty, forgetting her dread of seeing people in her desire to get away from that room, because for the first time in her life she wasn't at ease with Jack.
"I think I like the little gray moth better than the fine butterfly," returned Jack, who, in spite of his invitation, seemed to find moping rather pleasant.
"You are a rainy day friend, and he isn't," said Kitty softly, as she drew him away.
Jack's only answer was to lay his hand on the little white glove resting so confidingly on his arm, and keeping it there, they roamed away into the summer twilight. Something had happened to the evening and the place, for both seemed suddenly endowed with uncommon beauty and interest. The dingy old houses might have been fairy palaces for anything they saw to the contrary. The dusty walks, the trampled grass, were regular Elysian fields to them. And the music was the music of the spheres, though they found themselves right in the middle of the boom-jing-jing. For both had made a little discovery. No, not a little one. The greatest and sweetest man and woman can make. In the sharp twinge of jealousy which the sight of Kitty's flirtation with Fletcher gave him, and the delight he found in her after-conduct, Jack discovered how much he loved her. In the shame, gratitude, and half-sweet, half-bitter emotion that filled her heart, Kitty felt that to her Jack would never be only Cousin Jack any more. All the vanity, coquetry, selfishness, and ill-temper of the day seemed magnified to heinous sins. For now her only thought was, "Seeing these faults, he can't care for me.
Oh, I wish I was a better girl."
She did not say for his sake, but in the new humility, the ardent wish to be all that a woman should be, little Kitty proved how true her love was, and might have said with Portia, "For myself alone, I would not be ambitious in my wish, but for you, I would be troubled 20 times myself, 1,000 times more fair, 10,000 times more rich." All about them, other pairs were wandering under the patriarchal elms, enjoying music, starlight, balmy winds, and all the luxuries of the season. If the band had played, "Oh, there's nothing half so sweet in life as love's young dream," it is my private opinion that it would have suited the audience to a T. Being principally composed of elderly gentlemen with large families, they had not that fine sense of the fitness of things so charming to see, and tooted and banged away with waltzes and marches, quite regardless of the flocks of Romeos and Juliets philandering all about them. Under cover of a popular medley, Kitty overheard Fletcher quizzing her for the amusement of Miss Pinkbonnet, who was evidently making up for lost time. It was feeble wit, but it put the finishing stroke to Kitty's vanity, and she dropped a tear in her blue tissue retreat and clung to Jack, feeling that she had never valued him half enough. She hoped he didn't hear the gossip going on at the other side of the tree near which they stood, but he did, for his hand involuntarily doubled itself up into a very dangerous-looking fist, and he darted such fiery glances at the speaker that, if the thing had been possible, Fletcher's ambrosial curls would have been scorched off his head. "Never mind, and don't get angry, Jack. They are right about one thing. The daisies in my bonnet were real, and I couldn't afford any others. I don't care much, only Pris worked so hard to get me ready, I hate to have my things made fun of."
"He isn't worth a thrashing, so we'll let it pass this time," said Jack, irefully, yet privately resolving to have it out with Fletcher by and by.
"Why, Kitty, I thought the real daisies the prettiest things about your dress. Don't throw them away. I'll wear them just to show that noodle that I prefer nature to art." And Jack gallantly stuck the faded posy in his buttonhole, while Kitty treasured up the hint so kindly given for future use. If a clock, with great want of tact, hadn't insisted on telling them that it was getting late, Kitty never would have got home, for both the young people felt inclined to loiter about arm in arm through the sweet summer night forever. Jack had meant to say something before she went, and was immensely surprised to find the chance lost for the present. He wanted to go home with her and free his mind, but a neighborly old gentleman having been engaged as escort, there would have been very little satisfaction in traveling trio. So he gave it up. He was very silent as they walked to the station with Mr. Dodd trudging behind them. Kitty thought he was tired, perhaps glad to be rid of her, and meekly accepted her fate. But as the train approached, she gave his hand an impulsive squeeze and said very gratefully, "Jack, I can't thank you enough for your kindness to your silly little cousin, but I never shall forget it, and if I can ever return it in any way, I will, with all my heart." Jack looked down at the young face, almost pathetic now, with weariness, humility, and pain, yet very sweet, with that new shyness in the loving eyes, and stooping suddenly, he kissed it, whispering in a tone that made the girl's heart flutter, "I'll tell you how you may return it, with all your heart, by and by. Good night, my Kitty." "Have you had a good time, dear?" asked Pris, as her sister appeared an hour later.
"Don't I look as if I had?" And throwing off her wraps, Kitty revolved slowly before her that she might behold every portion of the wreck.
My gown is all dust, crumple, and rags, my bonnet perfectly limp and flat, and my gloves are ruined. I've broken Lizzie's parasol and made a spectacle of myself, and wasted money, time, and temper. Yet my class day isn't a failure, for Jack is the dearest boy in the world, and I'm very, very happy." Pris looked at her a minute, then opened her arms without a word, and Kitty forgot all her little troubles in one great joy. When Miss Smith and Miss Jones called a few days after to tell her that Mr. Fletcher was going abroad, the amiable creatures were entirely routed by finding Jack there in a most unmistakable situation. He blandly wished Horace bon voyage and regretted that he wouldn't be there to the wedding in October. Kitty devoted herself to blushing beautifully and darning many rents in a short daisy muslin skirt, "which I intend to wear a great deal, because Jack likes it, and so do I," she said, with a demure look at her lover, who laughed as if that was the best joke of the season. End of Kitty's Class Day by Louisa May Alcott.
Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
If you want jazz music, go to New Orleans. Bagels, New York. And for psychics, think California Psychics. You want the best, you go to the best. At California Psychics, home of free spirits and open minds, we know better than anyone what makes a good psychic. That's why we guarantee, if your reading isn't life-changing, it's free. Visit CaliforniaPsychics.com and experience the joy of certainty. California Psychics.